onto BBC Wiltshire Sound, where he works as a reporter, relief presenter and documentary maker. Involved with environmental campaigning and investigative journalism, he was secretary, then vice chair of the Bristol branch of the National Union of Journalists, and he delivered his first lecture on 17th century Illuminati in October 2006. He now produces and presents Friday Drive Time, the weekly politics show on Bristol Community FM. So on the phone to reveal his knowledge of a little known band of secret government villains known as the Bilderbergers, please welcome my next guest, Mr. Tony Gosling. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks very much for having me on. You know, this is a cross sort of cross area that I deal with, which is looking into this thing called the historical Illuminati, but then also being not afraid to draw some comparisons, and I'll leave it at that, just comparisons really, between them and this current day thing we've got called the Bilderberg Conference, and that's coming up next weekend. You may or may not be hearing about it, because sometimes the mainstream press will cover it a little bit, other times they completely ignore it. So it's actually probably fair to say the most powerful club in the Western world. That was reported in 1987 by The Economist. It was over Christmas 1987 when their main editors were off on holiday. I think the deputy editors or somebody cheekily decided to sneak some information in there for the public.
Get some real news in while nobody's watching.
Yeah, and they do the same in a way here in Bristol, actually, because a few years ago we had a fascinating conference, it was a long lecture over a day by a guy called Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yeah.
And they are really a wonderful organisation of thousands of architects and engineers, mainly based in the US, but now all over the world. And he did a presentation at the Colston Hall about 9/11. And we get no publicity for events like that. The mainstream press here would try and freeze them out completely. Mm. And yet, because it was a Monday edition, and it had been not the main editors and managers there at the weekend at the Evening Post here in Bristol, we got a front page on the Monday. The
Sounds
talk was
familiar.
On the Wednesday. And you know what they've done, Sarah? You won't believe this, but they have now stopped doing a Monday edition. They now do a weekend edition. So stop that kind of thing happening.
I hope heads didn't roll.
Well, I think what they do is when they see a little bit of a chink of the truth coming out like this in the mainstream press, they like to sit on it. Now, I mean, you know, I think we're living in a pretty frightening time as regards to what we are and are not allowed to hear in our news media nowadays. Sometimes things will get through and sometimes things won't. And, you know, I'm in an unenviable situation of meeting a lot of these politicians of the programme I do at Bristol Community Radio every Friday drive time. But, you know, you get a sense that something's not quite right. Some of the people that come in to be interviewed, and I really mustn't name names, but some of them do seem to be chameleon-like. You know, as soon as the microphone is switched on, then they're very groomed, but they're a different personality when they're off mic. The other thing is that people who are political opponents are also the best of friends. So, for example, a couple of maybe a year or so ago, I had two opposing politicians on the radio here one Friday evening, and there was a vox pop. I'd been out actually talking to some local people here about a particular issue, and they weren't even the vaguest bit interested in what local people were saying about this topic. They just wanted to have a little chit-chat with each other over the top, and they didn't even listen to the vox pops as they were going out.
I think politics is always seen by sort of the mainstream media and those who watch or take part in watching, buying, whatever on the television, the mainstream media. General population see politics as something apart from them, something separate, something different. It's boring, it's not interesting. I mean, we're talking about law today, dry old subject. But it does affect people, and today particularly we're talking about what is and what isn't law. And these Bilderberg group, this is a group of people who come in, couple of years, it was a good few years ago, wasn't it? In the 70s, was it? They held their meeting in Torquay. So yeah. we have been tainted by these group people.
Yeah, of course, there would have been no reporting on it in any of the national press at the time. In fact, most people in Torquay wouldn't have even known it was happening.
Exactly.
This is just how under the radar these incredibly powerful groups are.
And can you just explain for the listeners who haven't heard of them before, because many people haven't, because of the reasons you've just explained,
there's a whole tier of organisations like the Bilderberg. I mean, the Bilderberg I focus on because they're clearly the most powerful that are possible to do any kind of investigative journalism and reporting on. I mean, basically, the Bilderberg, it was set up after World War II with American intelligence money, the idea being to make sure that Europe was welded to the US and didn't have any thoughts or ideas of going to the left or joining forces with any of the former Soviet countries. I mean, for example, in Italy, they started going communist. As you might know, back in the 1970s, a lot of the Italians were voting communist.
Yeah.
And the American CIA spent millions, in fact, possibly even billions of pounds on fixing elections in Italy to make sure...
Probably why they had so many governments. Yeah.
They stayed with the US. So that was really the project, and it's an incredibly audacious idea that a few people in the intelligence services in the middle of World War II could decide, well, we're going to make sure that after the war, because they knew they were going to win the war by 1943, pretty much, and that they could say, well, we're going to start controlling the outcome, that is, to win the peace, and also for decades afterwards. So that's what they did. They set up this the first meeting in 1954 in Oosterbeek in Holland, which just so happened to be a place of the last great massacre of British troops, exactly the same place in the Battle of Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, 10 years previously, in 1944, just at the end of the war. And ever since then, they've been meeting in the United States or somewhere in Europe. But the idea really being that this is where politicians are selected.
Yes.
It's almost like a horse fair, that's how I see it. But they have to invite these politicians along and they think, well, we like this one, we don't like that one, we like this one. But the trouble is, a lot of the mainstream media people are there, you know, like Rupert Murdoch's general manager, people like that, top people. For example, you know, the deputy editor of Micklethwaite of The Economist is there, but he never writes about it in The Economist. Or if he was to mention it, it would only be in sort of laughable, oh, people think this is a powerful group terms.
Yes.
And I can tell you, this is the way the world really works. In those meetings, all the bankers, all the royalty, the people that control most of the money in the Western world, and that is why I find them so fascinating.
And this is not a conspiracy nonsense that people talk about. This is factual. I mean, you've been there. I know people that have been there. These people have been filmed there. They've been, you know, interviewed. They go there. Our politicians go there.
Well, there's nothing to stop people meeting up. Big business, people like that. Nobody would stop that. The thing I have a problem with is when you have our elected politicians going in there, and basically as they cross the threshold of the hotel, the conference room, move into the conference room, what they're doing is they're swearing a vow of secrecy. They really are. You know, they're not allowed to say to anybody on the outside what goes on inside.
Exactly.
That also is number one. But number two is the mainstream media people. BBC, for example, when Marcus Agius, he went when he was on the executive board of the BBC, and he's going into the meeting swearing an oath of secrecy, saying, well, I will not tell anybody on the outside what goes on in here.
So the question is, why are these people here? What are they doing? How does this affect the democratic process of lawmaking in this country?
Why do they need to swear secrecy?
Well, they don't.
Exactly.
But the thing is, if they don't, they won't be invited.
Yes.
You know, this is the part of the problem. And of course, when they are invited, they're told for the first time. They're told, well, you do realise that if you accept our invitation, you won't be able to breathe a word about it. It's called what's called the Chatham House Rules.
Yes.
And Chatham House is very much connected to the Bilderberg. It is an actual building in St James's in London. It's the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And if you look at the way foreign policy works and wars start or stop nowadays, diplomacy, that kind of thing, that's really where it happens, because it doesn't really happen at the Foreign Office anymore. The Royal Institute for International Affairs is a very powerful private club, which is also part-funded by the BBC, believe it or not. I mean, I'm quite amazed that our public money is going towards this. But essentially, what they've done is they've privatised foreign policy at Chatham House. And you'll quite often hear on the TV, radio, see on the TV, people from Chatham House being trotted out as spokespeople on international issues.
Yeah.
Oh, we've got a new war in Sudan, for example. Here's someone from Chatham House to tell you all about it. What they don't tell you on the BBC or on ITV or on Sky is that these people are privately funded, and it's a private foreign policy think tank which basically looks after the interests of big business.
Yeah.
So, did it come from the East India Company or something like that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily. No. I'm not sure about that. I think actually the Royal Institute for International Affairs, or Chatham House, which is where it's based in St James, it's part of a network of these sorts of organisations. The most similar of which is probably the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States.
And there's a European one as well, isn't there? Council
almost,
of 300.
Almost all countries have got one of these Institutes for International Affairs. And that's where foreign policy is decided nowadays, I'm afraid. It's not decided by our democratic leaders. I mean, you know, it's worth it, isn't it, looking at last week's election and the results, particularly of the Europol. You know, what we've got is we've got Nick Clegg on the radio today. I was listening to him on 5 Live earlier on saying, oh, well, you know, people just don't understand us. Well, I'm sorry, Nick, but they do understand.
Yes,
and
that's
what
why they're not voting.
Is that this European project is completely out of control. And when I say out of control, I mean it's out of our control.
Absolutely.
It's being run by appointees, you know. I think Hitler actually would be smiling and smirking if he was still alive, looking at what's happened with the EU and the European Central Bank, because it really is a handful of a hand-picked, unelected bunch of people making massive amounts of decisions about our economy and our new laws. So,
Hitler missed a few tricks there.
That's the worrying thing about all this, is that a lot of the problems that we're having now, today, are directly due to these European directives. Now, I'm not saying that our own government is particularly good or has any kind of real proper social conscience, but it's not the same kind of hideous machine that the EU is. Now, I mean, I say that advisedly because I knew very well a guy called Grattan Healey. Now, he's an engineer, and he worked for, this is back in the late 90s, he worked for a Green MEP. And he said, he worked there for about 4 or 5 years, and he said, I've always approached this Europe thing like an engineer and tried to see it as a machine and tried to make the machine work. And around about 2000, maybe it was 2001, he said to me, I've given up. This machine is never going to work.
Yeah.
And I think there are many people around Europe, in Ireland as well, obviously. Mostly, though, probably in Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, the places where this austerity has hit the hardest, that are also realising that we don't want anything to do with this machine anymore.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't do an audit on the machine every now and do a check-up, you're not going to find out where it's going wrong, are you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no great fan of the UK Independence Party, but I can see that what they're doing is actually really important. Is what they're doing is they're piercing this fake political consensus we've got in Britain, where both all three main parties, the Lib Dems, the Tories, and Labour, and actually now the Greens as well.
Yeah,
I mean, back in the sort of 5, 6, 8 years ago, the Green Party said, oh, well, we're against Europe and you can vote for us. Now they've changed their tune. They're now pro-EU. I shouldn't say Europe, and I do this all the time. Everyone does.
Yep, yep.
If the EU is not Europe, we're all pro-Europe. Yeah. We're just not pro-EU.
Just to the listeners who don't know what EU is, that's the European Union.
That's Brussels.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Strasbourg. And if you go right the way back to the war, you know, I was talking about World War II, because a lot of this, the ideas that we're seeing playing out today, started in World War II, was something in August 1944, which happened in Strasbourg, called the Red House Meeting. Now, all I'd suggest is that your listeners at some point use their favourite search engine to look that up. August 1944, the Red House Meeting, because it's where all the Nazis got together. This is the Nazi industrialists, not just the military people. And because they knew they were going to lose the war in August 1944. D-Day had been successful. They'd had the Falaise battle, Falaise gap, and the Nazis had realised, crikey, this lot are heading for Berlin now and there's nothing we can do to stop them. So they met. And Adam Labor has done a fantastic lot of research on this and various other people. But the Red House meeting, they made some decisions there about the way that they were going to get the looted wealth of Europe. The Nazis were going to squirrel it away in other parts of the world. Mm. And they did. And in fact, this battle, Operation Market Garden, the fact that it was a failure, and I would argue that there were forces on the British side there that were actually helping it to fail, It gave the Nazis another 6 months to make sure that they could get their wealth out of Germany to places like South America, Scandinavia, some cases also to as far away as Indonesia with the help of the Japanese, and that they could then revive their empire as a financial empire after World War II.
Absolutely.
And there's actually quite a lot of evidence for that.
That's a fair point. You're listening to The Lioness on Riviera FM. Today we're talking about law with my guest Tony Gosling on the phone. In the studio with me I have Nick and Max, and earlier on we were speaking to Danny Bamping. So, Tony, Bilderbergs.
Yeah, well, the question always seems to be, what are they up to?
You know?
And of course, if you imagine, you've got most of the money in the Western world, you've got some of the top political leaders too, plus the press. I mean, the people that own it, not the journalists, for the most part. And I always remind people of this, as a journalist myself, and a member of the journalist union, is that the journalists never control the transmitters and the printing presses. What we see most of the time is completely controlled by a kind of managerial bureaucracy. And you'll find most of the time, if you start rocking the boat, the managerial bureaucracy pulls the rug out from under your feet. I mean, you know, the way Bristol works, for example, as a city, is you've got a ruling elite, which here in Bristol is the merchant venturers. These people have made an absolute fortune out of the so-called financial crisis. All of this quantitative easing money that's being printed out of nowhere is going to puff up their share prices, and they're doing very, very nicely, thank you, out of it.
Yeah.
And they are really in charge of the city, you know. They own the city. They own big tracts of land. It's like they've got the Mayfair and Park Lane. and they also have quite a lot of sway over the top echelons of the various political parties, although I think it's probably fair to say the Labour Party in Bristol and the Greens aren't really, very close to them. But then you see you've got under them, you've got a substrata of a kind of business mafia, all of whom are desperate to become part of the merchant venturers, and they will go to almost any lengths to ingratiate themselves to the people that really own the city. And to a large extent, this is why people are so disillusioned with voting, why we've got only 30% or so turned out in this latest election, because, the other 60%, well, there's probably 10 or 20% that just couldn't be bothered anyway, but the other 40% or so are thinking to themselves, well, what's the point?
Yeah, we had a perfect example here. David Lowe from our local BBC was sacked recently. The voice doesn't fit, the face doesn't fit, and we'll find a reason to get rid of you.
That's right. Well, he was definitely bullied by the BBC and yes. by their human resources department, and that's a whole story in itself. I was sitting at a meeting, a BBC, mostly BBC people, about a month or so ago, where they just went off story after story about the horrendous way that people have been treated in the corporation. Mm. Basically managers doing things like thumping people, kicking their chairs, all that sort of low-level bullying where you're made to know that you're just not wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Putting people onto freelance rather than giving them contracts of employment, this kind of thing, so that you know that you're on the way out. And this is the way they manage things.
Absolutely. Well, there's zero-hour contracts coming in now with the DWP making people work for nothing. We've already had a show about that regarding whether we thought it was slavery or not.
Well,
I think the consensus of opinion is yes.
It certainly is slavery.
Yeah.
And we're moving towards that, I'm afraid. The old Britain never, never shall be slaves. Well, hang on a minute.
Just the English, Welsh and Scottish.
Yeah, if this government gets their way, they certainly will be. In fact, they are. Some people are. I mean, if you look at the way that animals are treated, there's quite a strict legal framework around whether you're allowed to... if you start starving an animal, you're committing a criminal offence. You can do something like a two-year jail sentence. Yet what's happening with the government is that they are fraudulently sanctioning people and they're taking away their food.
Exactly.
They're taking away their food money. This is a move towards slavery. It really is. And I think there's more and more people recognising that sort of creeping fascism is moving in. I mean, the idea that people, we heard today, for example, the idea that people are going to be sent to jail if they go off on holiday with their children during term time. Now, this is, whose children are they, excuse me?
We've already had parents jailed.
That's the question. That's a good question.
Getting back to the Bilderbergs, I think, it's important to focus on who and what they are. They are the political wing of NATO. NATO is in itself, takes very little notice of what politicians, you or I, say.
Well, they've got the bombs.
They've got their own objectives. they've got their own ideas about the way the world should be. For example, I mean, it's almost like going back to medieval times, where NATO looks upon its role as constantly taking territory, constantly taking over countries, constantly claiming resources, a bit like a sort of medieval bunch of brigands that every summer they go out getting booty. You know, they go out, they take out, get loads of resources.
And they have firms supplying them with weapons to do it as well.
Yeah, so. And of course, one of the major influences on NATO and at Bilderberg meetings are the two great, well, I say great, but the two big arms firms in Europe. There's one called EADS, which is an amalgam of several companies from the continent mainly, and then there's BAE Systems, you know, the British company. And those two are sitting in there, if you imagine how scary this is, you know, with some top politicians.
And John Major, for one.
People from all over the NATO countries. And this is one thing you notice, that if you're not in NATO, you're not in Bilderberg. You may be invited, there may be one or two people normally, like, for example, a kind of fake Iranian group were invited, and, you know, there are various kind of fake organisations that get an invite, like, I mean, they had someone from Moscow, but it was from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which is an American CIA front from Moscow, you know, so they will have a few people from other parts of the world, but they're all part of the Western Intelligence Service in that part of the world. But it's almost entirely, you know, like I say, almost entirely the NATO countries. And so that's why I look at this as what they've done is they've turned democracy upside down. They've said, mm-hmm. well, these organisations which are being funded by the taxpayer to defend us are now actually more powerful than our elected politicians and our press. And if any of the press start to really kick against them, they're simply either taken over or closed down.
Yeah. Or suicided.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions about, you know, certain fate of certain politicians and figures, aren't there? I mean, I think probably the most controversial is probably Robin Cook, as the chap who was a shoo-in, basically, to replace Tony Blair, so he would have almost certainly been Prime Minister instead of Gordon Brown. But you see, this is the way the Bilderbergers look, if they're always looking a little bit ahead as to who is going to be the next leader of the opposition. I mean, for example, just two examples. One was they invited Bill Clinton along to the Bilderberg meeting just a few months before he successfully got the Democratic nomination in the US and became president. They invited Tony Blair just before. In fact, they'd had John Smith had been along, the old Labour leader, if people could remember back that far, who then died, and then they had Tony Blair in. And the next year, Tony Blair became leader of the Labour Party.
They come out of nowhere, don't they? Obama came out of nowhere. Who'd ever heard of Obama until sort of the last minute, and then it was, oh, there's this guy, and he's a black guy,
well,
and isn't it wonderful?
You see that as well, don't you, on the television nowadays. You see TV reporters, and especially if there's some new conflict brewing up somewhere, some chap or woman will appear that you think, I've never seen them before. And what they're doing is they're explaining to you some amazingly complex new organisation. You know, I mean, like all this stuff about Boko Haram, for example, if you start drilling down into that, you can see that there has been US intelligence money via this thing called AFRICOM going into that part of the world for about a decade now. Now, that money is not going to no purpose. What they're doing is they're actually funding these groups with the idea that, oh, well, if we control the radical groups, then that will help us to stop them, and that will help us to know what they're up to. Well, that's the theory, but what often happens...
You mentioned Robin Cook. I mean, he famously stated that Al-Qaeda was actually a CIA database.
That's right. In fact, yeah, that was an article in The Guardian.
Indeed. Yeah.
Only just about 2 weeks before he
mysteriously died.
Of a heart attack, yeah, like John Smith.
Well, we can only surmise that he actually died of a heart attack.
Because
nobody was there when he died.
Indeed.
The helicopter came and took him off a mountain and left, unbelievably, told his wife, no, you're not allowed to get in the helicopter. And by the time he reached hospital, the man was dead, you know. So this is the kind of rather weird and scary world we're living in.
Well, Tony, there are a lot of these, aren't there? There are a lot of these. Well, we used to think about the Eastern Bloc and Russia and the bad guys and the Cold War, and we used to think, you know, you hear about disappearings, people were disappeared. And it sounds... unbelievable, really, to think that in 21st century Britain this is happening. But
if you look at the context of, I mean, I think Ukraine has been a real eye-opener, you know, because you look at what's happened in February in the Maidan protests in Kiev, where there was an assault by armed men on the parliament that took over. Now, that's a coup. Now, we don't get it referred to as a coup on the telly, but it was a coup, quite clearly. Now, the people who had conducted that we're not really sure exactly who. Nobody really seems to know who they are. But one thing you can be absolutely sure of is that in both the security services and the policing in the new Kiev government, you've got the Right Sector Party. Okay, they're called Pravi Sector in the Ukrainian. But they worship, I mean, I say that, I mean, they've got this guy on their walls, right? A guy called Stefan Bandera, who was a Nazi.
Yes.
Now, they've got him in the walls, and this is being supported by the European Union. This is being supported by the United States. This new government, which is a coup government, is being supported by them. So I think, in a way, it's very difficult to hide this away and say, oh, well, actually, no, we're not supporting Nazis. They are supporting Nazis. We've seen even just today in Ukraine more attacks on civilians by the Kiev army.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine if we had our army here in Britain, you know, descending on Torquay and attacking people in a demonstration in the street in Torquay.
Yeah.
You know, there would be all sorts of fuss, wouldn't there?
Well,
and
Theresa May has her way, that may well happen.
Well, let's hope to God it doesn't happen here. But I think, you know, in a way, that's why I think that the Ukraine is such an interesting warning to us about what might happen. And hopefully, our own military, because I know they don't necessarily go along with all this stuff, our own military will be looking at this thinking, hang on a minute, you know, what are they up to over there? And, you know, what's happening is, I think, hopefully, there is a bit of an understanding now in Britain amongst our professionals, you know, the ones we don't see on the TV, you know, the ones that don't roll onto Newsnight and onto the news, that, you know, we need to be ready for this kind of thing possibly to happen here. Because I think it's pretty fair to say that Eastern Ukraine was ready for the coup in Kiev, and they have decided, no, we're going to put up roadblocks, we're not going to allow these groups of armed gangs of fascists to go driving around willy-nilly all around the east of Ukraine, we're going to stop them, and they have done.
And good for them, and good luck to them too. I mean, it's a terrible way to live. It's a dreadful way to have to bring up your children in that fear and that uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this is to do with money, isn't it? I mean,
the
whole business to do with Ukraine is about who are you. It's almost like switched their bank account. You know, they switched their bank account from Moscow to Brussels. And this is the result of it all. You know, what they did actually was the other way around, wasn't it? They said, Yanukovych, the previous president, said, no, we're going to keep our bank account in Moscow. And then there was a coup. Now, it's Victoria Nuland from the US, she was their, ambassador, I think it's an envoy to Kiev, special envoy. She admitted on a leaked phone call that the Americans have spent about £2 billion in funding the Kiev protest, right? This is the Maidan. That is actually paying people to be out on the streets.
Yeah.
This is saying to people, well, join this little organisation and we will pay you some money, but we will ask you to come out on the street in a protest and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, I think, didn't realise where the money was coming from. And, you know, a lot of people, poor people, will do that. They'll just go, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And anyway, we don't like the government, so we'll do it.
Yeah.
So that's how they did
it. And basically, this would have been decided at Bilderberg, wouldn't it?
I don't think necessarily at Bilderberg, no. It would probably be decided by people who were there. Because Bilderberg is more of a PR exercise. What is happening is the military-industrial complex, the Henry Kissingers of this world, the covert planners behind the scenes, they're inviting the politicians along to have a look at them and also to see, well, I don't think the big deals are done at Bilderberg.
Yeah.
What they're doing is they're building relationships.
These are auditions.
Right, networking.
I think audition is the perfect way to put it.
I do. Does your face fit? Are you going to toe the company line? Are you going to make us money? And are you prepared to lie?
And one thing we haven't even mentioned is the fact that the chairman of the Bilderberg for the first 20 years, from the mid-50s to the mid-70s, was the former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, you know, he was in the SS in the run-up to the war. Then, like Philip, married into the British royal family, he married into the Dutch royal family, and he was then began to be trusted, amazingly. Ian Fleming, the Bond author, was involved in signing off his security credentials. He was entrusted in some parts of the war planning, for example, in Operation Market Garden, I was talking about earlier, you know, the liberation of Holland, which was so crucial to try and end the war early. He was in on all the planning of it. And then he sends this guy who's supposed to be a top secret agent in to contact the resistance in Holland. It turns out Bernhard's trusted man is actually working for the Nazi, the Abwehr, which is the German military intelligence. He goes straight to them and tells them all about Operation Market Garden 2 weeks before it actually happened. So that was one of the reasons that the whole thing was such a disaster. Of course, it's the 70th anniversary coming up September this year, and I imagine that will be one of the sorts of things that would be whispered around Dutch churches and things where they're
let's hope it's sort of spoken about rather than whispered now. I think
yes, well, we're here to speak about it, certainly.
I think maybe people are a little bit more open about these sorts of things nowadays, and that there were collaborators involved.
We seem to be talking a lot about Nazis, don't we?
Yeah, if you look at the other chairman of the Bilderberg Conference, it's interesting who they choose to be in charge. I mean, the other person who's very powerful was Lord Carrington.
Mm-hmm.
He was chairman for, I think, 5 years or so.
He was also involved with Henry Kissinger and Kissinger Associates, wasn't he?
I'm not sure.
I believe so.
Kissinger Associates is a fascinating organisation, and Kissinger himself is he runs a sort of global protection racket, you know.
Yes.
So what you've got is you've got some poor little country in Africa. They suddenly start getting all these problems we've had with Boko Haram, this kind of thing. And you go to the United Nations, and the United Nations can't do anything, and they phone you back and they say, well, we're very sorry, we haven't got any spare troops. And then you get on the phone to Henry Kissinger and you get out your credit card, and he takes your number and your credit card details. Apparently it's $1 million minimum to talk to him. And then what will happen is you will do a deal with Kissinger, and then all the trouble will stop. So that's basically the way Mr. Kissinger works.
So really is our fundamental point here that we're talking today here on Riviera FM. We're talking about law, and what is it?
Well, it's the law of the jungle, isn't it?
It's certainly not the rule of law.
It's the law of the sea.
It's not the rule of law, is it? It's not the fact that we are all equal, that laws are written to protect some, to prosecute others.
There's an erosion of the rule of law right around the world. I think that's pretty clear. I mean,
right, from before election of government and then all the way through. And even what we've got 3 minutes left here to discuss this. What would your view be on the fact that we are a constitutional monarchy here? Because obviously all laws that are written off and signed off have to be signed off by Elizabeth Windsor.
We had the revelation, didn't we? Yeah, this whole revelation about the Windsors signing, or shall we say, the Saxe-Coburg Gotha.
But they've always, she's always given royal assent to all legislation, but she's not an elected. And she can say yay or nay. So where does leave the
Elected Parliament?
Well, my
own view of the way this works, I think the Queen is actually reasonably decent and honourable. But Prince Charles is taking us down a very, very different road. He really does see himself as in charge. And, you know, he takes the whole business of the international affairs very seriously. You know, this whole business of him accusing Putin of being like Hitler, behaving like Hitler, really just shows how incredibly out of touch he is.
The irony of that
statement, I think, is missing in
Well, it was
many
very
people.
Interesting. I was talking on Friday to Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's one of the senior Conservatives, very, very rich chap. We had him on the radio. And he was saying, well, he didn't, you know, when I asked him about Charles and Putin and his statement, he was saying, well, actually, I think you've got to be rather careful when you're talking to your people who are your future allies.
Mm.
Which is a very interesting way of putting it. He didn't really say, no, Prince Charles shouldn't have said it, but he said he's quite clearly not able to perform the role that we, you know, expect as someone in that position. The Queen seems to be much better at it.
She's had a lot more experience, hasn't she?
But anyway, keep your eyes on the Bilderbergs. We'll have some live reports from there on our show next Friday, Drive Time.
And is happening next week, is it?
It's happening, starting on the Thursday, running through till Sunday over in Copenhagen. And I imagine Ukraine and the new Cold War will be on the agenda. Also, they will be looking to close on us as their austerity drive turns us into paupers, basically. Yeah. But we're on thisweek.org.uk if any of your listeners want to try and tune in. I don't imagine you'll pick us up on FM all the way from Bristol.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thisweek.org.uk, and that's on when? Thursday?
That's on Friday from 5 till 7. We'll have a politician on there from 5 till 6, and then 6 till 7 we'll be live over in Copenhagen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fascinating. If you just joined us and listening, this is Tony Gosling, a lioness here on Riviera FM.
I want to get a book of B&B down there sometime and come on, in the flesh.
You're more than welcome. It's lovely down here. It's raining today, but it's lovely usually. So you're more than welcome. And thank you. I can't thank you enough.
Well, I can't thank you enough for asking me on. Thanks ever so much. Well, and we've gone round the BBC today, haven't we? Round the side of them.
We have, absolutely. And so we should. At least we'll get some news out. Right. Thank you very much.